St. George's number one station with Washington County's top talk show. The Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU.
Welcome to the program. I'm Andy. Thank you for tuning in today. It's a weird kind of day in Utah's Dixie. Going to be windy throughout the day and then rain in the late afternoon, early evening, and more sogginess. So it's going to ruin my pickleball game tonight, but other than that, we're good. Thanks for tuning in. We have a couple of folks here. A different topic today. I think it's going to be fascinating. Lisa Brown is here. She is a board member for the Southwest Forensic Nursing Healthcare. Right, Lisa? Did I get that right?
Yes. And
she brought with her an expert, the clinical director for the Southwest Forensic Healthcare. That is Camden Kafa. Camden, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having us.
Appreciate you being here. Now, let's get to know, first of all, what is Southwest Forensic Healthcare? What does that mean?
Yeah, Southwest Forensic Nursing and Healthcare is a new nonprofit here in Washington County that provides services to survivors of sexual and physical violence.
Really? Okay.
Yes. So we are the healthcare side of these survivors' needs after a sexual assault or a physical assault, domestic violence, where we provide one-on-one care to these individuals. That's, in their time of need.
That's a pretty cool service. But I know the average Utahn, especially the average St. Georgian, would go, well, we don't have that problem here in southern Utah.
Unfortunately, we do.
We do.
Yes. It's we in Utah, we actually have higher statistics than a large number of our other states in the nation, that we have more sexual violence and domestic violence in our state than the average.
Oh, that is disheartening, actually, to hear. That's terrible. We'll get into more about what you guys do, but I do want to get to know you guys a little bit. Lisa's been on the show before, right, Lisa?
I have. I have worked for Intermountain Healthcare in the past, and I was over the Jubilee of Trees, which is why I came to visit
with
you.
Right, yeah. And I assume the Jubilee was successful when you were...
It was successful and did another successful one after that, and they are still successful.
Still doing
it. So that's
good. Love it. Well, thank you, Lisa, for coming on. Camden, now tell us about yourself. Where are you from? How did you end up here? And kind of a little bit about yourself.
Sure, absolutely. So I was a military brat, so I've lived in quite a few different places in our nation growing up.
So your dad was in the military?
My dad was in the Air Force.
Air Force, okay. Yep. Was he a pilot or?
He was a navigator for B-52s.
Wow. Well, that's pretty cool.
Very proud of that, might I say. So we traveled all over the nation, lived on the East Coast, West Coast, up in Washington State. But both my parents are from Utah, grew up here from the Linden Pleasant Grove area.
Okay.
And I ended up staying in Southern California, was the last base he was stationed at. And I stayed there for college after they left. But eventually, after having children in Southern California, decided that I wanted a nicer place for my children to grow and to be closer to family. So we moved to St. George because I don't really do snow and most of the family is up north. But this was my, you know, medium stop where we can come.
Your olive branch, say, I'm coming to Utah. Not coming up there, but I'm coming to Utah.
Yes, absolutely. So I've been here since 2006.
Oh,
so quite a while.
Time.
Raised my children here, and two of them are in college now. One at SUU, and one that just left Utah Tech and went up to Utah University.
University of Utah, right down there in Salt Lake, huh?
Yes.
Do they like snow? Because they're going to get it.
They're learning. And this has been quite the inaugural year for both of them to enjoy that snow.
Oh, just like record snowpack, whatever, you know.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Well, we're glad you're here. 17 years. So it's funny. I've been here 30 years. In 1993 is when we came to town. I'm still a newcomer, according to some of the lifers here, right? Lisa, how long have you been in town?
The same time as you.
Yeah, 93 or so.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And we're still newcomers, right?
They're like, well, but I figure it's a free United States, and I can live anywhere and call at home.
Well, at this point, I mean, when we moved here in the early 90s, there was like 40,000 people in St. George. Now there's 100. So
correct.
We've seen a lot of change over the last few years. All right. So Southwest Forensic Nursing and Southwest Forensic Healthcare, and then tell us what the details are on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a team of forensically trained nurses who provide one-on-one care to those specialized victims or survivors that come into the hospital here locally. So we're an independent nonprofit that has a contract with Intermountain Healthcare to provide services at the local emergency department or any other unit in the hospital. And so we have a team of on-call staff who take call 24/7, 365. We have someone available to get that call from the hospital that they have a survivor who is presented and that needs specialized health care. And so we go in and perform all the health care needs that they may need in conjunction with the emergency department team or the hospital-based team of the unit that they're staying on.
So do you have a physical office here that you guys work out of? Or
so we have a very small office that Intermountain Healthcare has provided for us within the emergency department.
Okay.
But we don't yet have a physical building outside of the hospital. It is one of our goals as we move forward in the community and establish our our space here, because, you know, it requires funding.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's something that currently the program is being funded by two of the nurses who have the passion to do this work, myself and Megan Riddle. I want to give her kudos, because without her, this team would not be in the state that it is today. This team has been present in providing care since the early 2000s, but it's gone through a couple of ownerships and transitions over those years, where it was nurse-owned for quite a few years, and then it was physician-owned from 2011 to just this past March of 2022. So during those times, I worked for the team from the time that I moved here in 2007 and have been part of their program. And from 2011 to last March, I have been the clinical director for the team. But when our local physician, I also want to give him some kudos, Dr. Robert Foster, who is one of our ER doctors, he was the owner of the team. And we just really needed to move the team forward into a nonprofit status because we were struggling with funding and the things that we need to do this work. So we needed to move out of an LLC physician ownership into a nonprofit status so that, okay, we could apply for grant funding and seek community resources to help us moving forward and get us the equipment and supplies and hopefully at some point a clinic space to be able to offer examinations outside of the emergency department.
So talk about the process now for you guys when you are needed. Do you get a call from the emergency room? Do you get a call from a victim? Do you get a call from a doctor? What is the process?
So most of the time we're getting the call from the emergency department. Most of our patients present there. Many times that may be the first person that they tell that this has happened to. They go to seek health care, looking for maybe treatment for a sexually transmitted infection or wanting to get pregnancy prevention measures in place. Many times they don't know that this forensic nurse team is available, and that's part of us being here today, is sure, to let people know that they will have specialized care should they show up at the emergency department with a complaint of being sexually or physically assaulted. This team, you know, we do rely on the emergency department to call us, but occasionally we will get referrals from our partnerships, such as the Dove Center or mm-hmm. law enforcement, if they happen to call a crisis line. So there are statewide sexual assault crisis numbers. If they happen to call that number, then they're generally referred to a community advocacy agency, which here in Washington County is the Dove Center. The Dove Center will then take that call from that survivor and then find out, you know, when did this happen? What resources do you need? Is it within the time frame to have a medical forensic examination? And then they will refer them to the ER. And occasionally we'll get the call from the Dove Center saying we have a survivor who's planning to go to the ER, but generally we don't dispatch a nurse until we know that they're going to be coming in or present.
Let's talk about that time frame. You mentioned it. Sexual assault is, first of all, it's such an emotional thing for the victims. A lot of them are afraid to even say anything. Sometimes they blame themselves. Whatever the reason is, sometimes they just don't want to talk about it. And then you end up with maybe a week later or a month later, they finally say, all right, I need to talk to somebody about this. Have they missed out at that point of being forensically examined and getting that taken care of?
Yeah, so right now in the state of Utah, our time frame, we work hand in hand very closely with our crime lab, our law enforcement partners, and our prosecutors. There is a local sexual assault response team that includes all of these partnerships where we meet once a quarter to discuss these things. But the Crime Lab has really set a 5-day standard in the state for medical forensic examinations. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't go past that 5-day time frame. Right now, Wasatch Forensic Nurses is the largest forensic nurse team in the state. They cover Salt Lake County, Utah County, Summit County, and Wasatch counties. And so they're seeing well over 1,000 patients a year.
Wow.
For their team, because they cover such a large area and a densely populated area. And so they're currently doing a research study going out 6 and 7 days past the sexual assault time frame to see, are we still gathering evidence? Are we still seeing injury and trauma on these survivors that require health care? And so we are definitely looking to expand that time frame past the 5 days. And right now, kind of what our general rule is that for sure, if it's within 5 days, we will always offer an exam. If it's past 5 days, we're going to kind of chat with that survivor about extenuating circumstances, such as, do you still have pain somewhere on your body? Do you still have visible injuries somewhere?
Bruises, yeah.
Do you have concerns about sexually transmitted infections that we can, you know, still are within the time frame to prevent or treat? There are some things that are very time sensitive in the healthcare treatment arena, such as HIV prevention. That has to be done within a 72-hour time frame or it is not effective. So if someone has a concern that the perpetrator is HIV positive, then we would really encourage them to try to come in before that 72-hour mark so that we can offer them HIV prevention measures. But emergency contraception, which is a medication that can help prevent pregnancy from occurring, that we can give up to 5 days post-sexual assault. And then for sexually transmitted infections, we can either test or prophylax pretty much at any time.
Wow. I'm not going to lie, Camden. I'm a little ashamed that this is such a big factor in Utah and even in St. George, Utah. I'd like to think that we're all good people and we're not going to do that to another person. But I guess just the fact that you guys even exist means that that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I would love to address some of the what we call rape myths out there.
Okay.
Because a lot of us are subjective to what we see on the television.
Unfortunately,
or on
yes.
Netflix or whatever.
I saw it on Law and Order, so it must be.
Exactly. Law and Order SVU, you know, showed what a victim should look like and what rape looks like.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, they do have some trauma-informed shows out there, but for the majority of them, they are not very trauma-informed.
It's Hollywood.
Yes. They're going for ratings and for shock and awe, right? Because that's what makes people continue watching.
Sure.
But what we need to understand is that the stranger jumping out of a bush at night and pinning someone down and sexually assaulting them is an extremely rare instance.
It's unusual.
Does it happen?
That's what we think
yes.
of when we think of rape. Someone, yeah, but you walked alone at night, you got attacked. That's what we all think of.
Absolutely. Yeah. But that's not the common sexual assault survivor that we see. So, unfortunately, we are in a place where, as a community, we're teaching young women or women in general to be aware of your surroundings. Make sure you lock your car when you first get in the door. Carry a whistle. I mean, there was years we told college students to carry a whistle around their neck to prevent them from being sexually assaulted, which what we're doing with those things when we're teaching that way is we're telling these people, it's your fault if it happens to you. So when we set up that standard that women should prevent this by doing certain things, dressing a certain way, don't have any alcohol, don't be in a vulnerable situation, don't go on dates with people you don't know, carry a whistle. When we're saying those things, we're then putting this message out there saying, if you get sexually assaulted, it's your fault because you didn't do this, this, and this, and this. And unfortunately, that's what our survivors believe. They believe that they're somehow at fault for what happened because of how our, you know, media and community has built up this how to protect yourself method.
Well, it's kind of weird when you say that because we still want them to protect themselves, right? We just don't want them to have the mindset that it's their fault. I mean, if I tell my wife, I don't want her to, she goes walking early in the morning. I tell her, I don't want you to walk by yourself. She has someone she walks with. I'm not trying to put the message to her that it would be her fault if she got raped, but I certainly don't want her to get raped. And so I'm glad she has someone to walk with. You know what I mean?
Right, like, yeah, no, absolutely. I hear you. And I think that's definitely a perspective that we can look at with, certainly we want people to protect themselves to help prevent. But what we really need to be doing, because like I said, it's not the stranger jumping out of the bushes. Mm. It's most commonly someone they know. Mm. So when a sexual assault occurs from someone they either trust or that they know on a certain level, an acquaintance of some kind, maybe it's a boss, maybe it's a coworker, maybe it's another student that they met in class, if they're a university or high school age student, or, you know, someone they met on a dating app. And that's another myth that we really need to get around. Just because someone agrees to go on a date, no matter what app it is that they chose to find someone to date, that doesn't mean that it's consent to have that individual touch their body,
right,
as part of the date. So we, when we're, you know, teaching these things about it being a stranger and protecting yourself from strangers, we're not doing that with our acquaintances. We're not saying, you know, don't get in a car with a friend that you know from campus. When, guess what? That's actually when sexual assaults happen.
Yeah.
more likely to happen. Don't drink, because then that makes you vulnerable to sexual assault, which on a certain level, certainly, because our perpetrators are looking for those who are vulnerable, but it's someone that they know and that they trust many times.
Right.
So that makes it all that more shaming and guilting to that survivor, because, well, if I had only done these things, then this wouldn't have happened to me. When instead, what we need to be teaching our community is, what is consent? What does that look like? How does that sound? What are the interactions between individuals consensually getting together for intercourse or whatever it might be? And instead of saying no means no, we really want to get out of that mindset and say yes means yes. So we need to teach not just men, but those, anyone going into a consensual sexual encounter, of what yes looks like, sounds like, feels like. Because if you have someone who doesn't give that enthusiastic yes, I want to do this, then you need to evaluate, are they really consenting to what's happening here?
Let's talk about trust a little bit. Yeah, I mean, you've talked about it a couple of times. That seems to be where most of the perpetrators and the victims of these perpetrators, that seems to be when it happens most. It could be a family member or maybe somebody who has a position of authority over you, whether it's at work or you mentioned at school or college or whatever. What does that do to the mindset of the victim going in and then coming out of the assault? Because you mentioned guilt is involved there when maybe it shouldn't, well, probably it shouldn't be. I just talk about the matter of trust and how this all fits into everything.
Yeah, it just increases the level of shame and guilt of our survivors, which then increases the likelihood that they're not going to report to law enforcement or to a healthcare provider, or possibly to anyone who can help them, such as the Dove Center or a close family friend, because they're so shamed by what did I do to cause this that they then don't seek the help that they need. And sexual trauma and physical trauma, such as intimate partner violence and domestic violence, those have long-term effects for our survivors. It's going to affect their job status, their ability to go to work and be a productive individual of our community. It's going to affect their health. Many people who have trauma such as this in their past have chronic health issues, such as chronic abdominal pain, migraines, headaches. There's a whole slew of medical problems that, yes, is there something physical going on? Yes, we want to believe them when they say they have these physical problems, because it's their body's manifestation of the trauma that they're holding in, because they don't seek therapy. They don't seek being able to talk about what happened to them because of that level of shame. And then it also makes them more vulnerable to future physical and sexual violence, because they now have devalued themselves because of that shame and guilt and those trust issues, where They create blame, and then they become more vulnerable to it happening again because they then don't value their bodies and their integrity.
Hmm. That's just the whole thing. Like I said, is pretty heartbreaking. What about the family part of trust? I had a neighbor, and I'm not going to say any names or anything like that, but he molested one of his grandchildren. I think probably tore that family apart. I didn't know the rest of the family very well. I just knew the perpetrator, and he went to jail for a time for it. But it to me, I mean, we're talking about, you know, this little, what is it, the butterfly's wings in Asia effectively, you know, what mm-hmm. this little ripple affected this whole family.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I probably should state, too, that our team handles age 14 and older.
Okay, so you don't do kids.
So we see adolescents and adults, and the Children's Justice Center here in town handles all the pediatric or minor okay. patients, and we kind of share that 14 to 17-year-old age group. They can go to the CJC, or they can come to the ER and be seen by our team. So we don't deal with the youngsters, but we certainly have adolescents who are being assaulted by a position of trust, a family member, family friend, or, you know, a teacher or someone like that. And it does have a huge ripple effect. There certainly are going to be effects for any survivor of violence. Their close-knit relationships are going to be affected. And, you know, rates of suicide increase. Yeah. In these cases, that's been documented statistically. So getting them therapy and counseling, and not only for the survivor, but those who care and love for them, we call them secondary survivors to this, they also are going to need therapy, counseling, or some type of outlet that helps them deal with this level of trauma, because it can be very significant.
Yeah, I just think about this, obviously the victim, but also this man's wife and this mm-hmm. man's daughter and everyone that was involved in this whole thing. It's just certainly very heartbreaking. Okay, so let's get a break in. We got to get a commercial break in. We're going to take some texts and phone calls, too, and just talk about this. But as we go to break, though, can you tell us, we said it's happening here in Southern Utah. Can you give us an idea of how common this is? Is there a sexual assault every day, several a day, every hour in Southern Utah?
So the hard part is we know that reporting doesn't happen very often. So statistics are a little bit hard to pin down because, in general, we know there's a lot of survivors who never tell another soul at all, not even a person of trust.
Sure.
But the latest Utah statistics occurred in 2015. There is a current survey being done of the public in Utah to be able to update our numbers. But what we know is nationally, 1 in 6 women experience some level of sexual violence in their lifetime.
Wow.
In our 2015 study here in Utah, it was 1 in 4. Like I was mentioning, we have a higher incidence mm-hmm. of sexual violence. Now, when I say sexual violence, that's not always rape. That can be groping or other, sexual type crimes. But still, we do know that we have that high number. So if you think 1 in 4, everybody knows 4 women in their life, whether that be a mother, sister, daughter, friend, mm-hmm. You think about 4 women in your life, one of those has experienced some form of sexual violence. And you may not ever know if they reported or what happened. I mean, I don't suggest you go out and ask all of your friends and family whether or not they've been sexually assaulted, unless you have a relationship where you can build upon that and make sure that you're offering them help. But we need to start by believing our survivors when someone reports that they've been sexually assaulted, and help reduce that shame and guilt that they're feeling so that they can seek help and not continue to have health problems and mental health problems in their future.
Awesome.
But I certainly could give quite a few more statistics about age groups and things if you're
Get into that after the break.
Sounds
good. She's Camden. Lisa's over there, not saying much, but she's here. And this is the Andy Griffin Show. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back. I'm Andy Griffin. Thank you for tuning in today. Kind of a sobering topic today as we talk about sexual assault with Camden Kafa and Lisa Brown from the Southwest Forensic Healthcare. These are the folks that get called in if there has been a sexual assault mostly adolescents to, through adults, to investigate, to collect evidence, to find out whatever help the person who was assaulted needs. How do you evaluate that when you get there? There's got to be a lot to take in, and you got to, it's almost like a triage, right? You have to figure out what happened, why it happened, how it happened. And I guess the courts are not very forgiving. You've got to make sure you've got all your ducks in a row.
Yeah, absolutely. I do want to say that healthcare is our number one priority. We are nurses first, and okay. ensuring that they are healthy and safe is going to always be our priority over the forensic piece of what we do. But we are going to ask a bunch of detailed questions about their medical history and about the assault history and what happened to them, because then that helps guide us in our examination where we need to look for areas of trauma, whether that be surface trauma or internal trauma. If there was a strangulation, that happens about 25% of the time that
really?
There was strangulation involved in the sexual assault, because remember, this is about power and control. It's not about sexual gratification. So the strangulation can be a life-threatening incident. If they don't, you know, pass away at the time of the assault with the strangulation, they are still at great risk for life-threatening health problems after the strangulation has occurred up to the next couple of days because of swelling and other injuries that could have occurred internally to the neck. So we're doing a very thorough head-to-toe exam. I do want to say that we do not do anything that our patient does not want us to do.
Right.
So we are allowing them to be the guide as we do this examination and ask these questions, and we but we would like to do a very thorough head to toe. We're kind of checking every surface area, looking for bruises, abrasions, and then we are collecting forensic evidence based on the history of the assault that occurred and the signs and symptoms that we're seeing on their physical body, because in sexual assault the number one crime scene is the human body of
right.
of the assault, where the assault occurred. So we are swabbing areas, looking at areas, photographing the injuries that we find. We do follow law enforcement standards as far as our medical forensic photography, making sure that we get every angle of that injury along with scale of the injury. And then throughout this exam, we're also checking, do they need shelter? Can we? The Dove Center is, we ask them to be present for our examinations as well, because they're offering so many aftercare services
right.
that our team is focused on that healthcare exam. And the Dove Center is really our partner to offer shelter, counseling and therapy and other resources that our state does have funding to help these survivors. So the exam is always free. There is zero charge to the survivor for the examination or for the ED visit. So all of the medications that we recommend and they receive, all of that is free of charge. So if anyone is thinking, well, I don't want to go to the ER because I don't have the money to pay for this, that should not be a factor in their decision, because they will receive no charge whatsoever for that examination.
This is maybe a little bit of a naive question, but and I know every case is different, but generally speaking, are victims recommended to fight back, to try to resist these assaults? Have you found that there is more damage done for someone who resists versus someone who doesn't?
Yeah, thank you so much for that question. That goes right into our kind of trauma response knowledge,
mm-hmm.
is that, once again, on TV, we see the screaming, kicking, fighting, running
right.
Victim, which statistically we know is not accurate. That is such a small percentage of our victims who do those things during an assault. Those are more common to occur in a stranger assault, which I've already told you is not
pretty
typically what happens. It's
yeah.
pretty rare. So when you know someone, that survivor, as this is happening, is thinking, how is this person that I trust or maybe even love doing this to me?
Right.
And so many times, and even if it's not someone that they know really well, but just an acquaintance, they're still in that space of, is this really happening?
Right.
And what our body does naturally, our brain is designed to, we've heard fight, flight,
fight,
right?
Fight, yeah.
But there's also another, there's freeze.
Yeah,
and in
the third
sexual,
one that,
yeah.
that we don't talk about
we
as much.
We don't talk
but
about
it's real.
As much, but in domestic violence and sexual assault, it is much, much more common that the freeze response is what the brain utilizes to protect that survivor. So the person generally does not fight back, which it can result in less injuries if they're not fighting back, which is a protective measure for them. Mm-hmm. So our team also are expert witnesses, so we can go into the courtroom and explain that trauma response and also explain why maybe there weren't a lot of injuries.
So someone in court might be saying, well, they didn't fight back, they must have wanted it.
Right.
Right?
Right. And yeah, we can hopefully go in and educate our juries, which is our community, mm-hmm, that that's not what women do in general, and even men when they're sexually assaulted tend not to fight back. And a lot of people think that men can't be sexually assaulted. That's absolutely not true. We do have male survivors, a lower percentage, but still it is happening.
Well, and the thing you mentioned about the being a person that maybe this victim trusted, that is a huge factor when you're talking about whether or not they're going to fight back. If this person is saying to you, it's okay, this is supposed to happen, or it's okay, you know, don't worry about it, I got it covered or whatever, then the victim is going to be like, well, I guess I don't know, I guess I should just let this happen. And that's probably happens a lot.
Well, there's that moment of shock.
Yeah.
And the trauma that the brain just kind of shuts down as well. Mm. They can actually go into like a dissociative state many times where they almost remove themselves from the situation.
So their brain is out of there even though their body is being assaulted.
Absolutely. And that freeze response can also result, and the trauma of what's happening to them can result in a lack of memory storage of the event.
Really?
So then that also leads people to, well, if you don't remember what happened, did this really happen?
Right.
Then once again, that shameful feeling and those guilts that come to those survivors because they may not have a full chronological memory of what occurred to them. So then they also add that self-blame, but then they think, well, law enforcement's never going to believe me, or maybe my doctor's never going to believe me because I don't even know exactly everything that happened. But that's the brain's protective response. And in that trauma response, they're storing those memories in different ways within their brain that keep them from either retrieving them, or they come up jumbled or mixed as they do come to recall those memories in the future.
You hear the stories about someone who was assaulted 30 years ago and they've repressed it. They put it somewhere in some little box in the corner of their brain, and then something happens 30 years later and all of a sudden they get triggered. They remember that. Read a couple texts to you. Someone asking about gender changing surgery and talking about sexual things. Is that a sort of sexual assault? Kind of a weird question, but
Well, it all comes down to consent.
Okay.
So if there's an individual who is choosing gender surgery, then that's something that they need to have informed consent about, what the changes are going to be to their body
They should be an adult, would think, then.
Yeah. I mean, I know that there are some states that are allowing adolescents to do gender reassignment or change options. That's a very, very individual situation that the family support and the person who is choosing that, because the trauma of living in a body that doesn't match who you feel you are can also be cause for suicide and very significant mental health issues.
A couple of other texts. Someone said they were almost raped in St. George a few years ago. Again, kind of driving home the fact that it happens here. It said the person had a knife and it was very close to being a sexual assault type thing. Mm-hmm. We need to probably, and you probably walk around going, wake up, everybody, this does happen here in our town. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. It's happening in our town
at
astonishing numbers. Unfortunately, the large percentage of survivors of sexual assault are not reporting it. So I do want to mention on that note that if they are 18 or older, they do have the option to come see our team on what we call a restricted reporting basis, where they can come and receive health care and do an evidence collection kit and choose not to be involved in a law enforcement investigation. And our law enforcement partners are being trained on all this trauma that is out there with sexual assaults and how people react. And that training is now leading them to understand that they should not be forcing these survivors into an investigation or into prosecution or moving forward within the judicial or legal process, because that can be sometimes more traumatizing to our survivors. I know our community would like to say, well, let's get these people off the streets. We'd all love for that to happen, but we also don't want to cause more trauma to someone who's already been traumatized. So we're now providing options where that person who has experienced this event of sexual violence has a choice about how this moves forward within the judicial system and the legal system, and they can still get health care. That's the main thing I want them all to know, is that they can come to us, we can do the examination, provide them all of the medications to prevent things, and law enforcement does not have to be involved. Now, we are a mandatory reporting state, though, so there are a few items of information legally as a nurse we have to report, such as their name and information, phone number, and the level of injury that was diagnosed or seen upon exam. But we also partner with law enforcement to say, but this person who is an adult is saying, I don't want to be interviewed by law enforcement right now. I don't want to move forward with an investigation. And law enforcement is honoring that request now, knowing how trauma affects people.
Yes. So how long does the person have once the evidence is collected and that has been sent to law enforcement, do they have to, if they choose,
right,
to move forward?
So that evidence is being held in the state of Utah for 20 years.
Oh, okay.
So it used to be 90 days. 5 or 6 years ago, we only allowed them a 90-day window to come and tell law enforcement, okay, now I want this investigated, where now it's 20 years because we're now better understanding trauma in the brain and those recall memories.
That person that had said they were almost raped, they said the person that was assaulting them had AIDS. And I wonder, does that, I guess that's part of the evidence you collect, right? Because if you knowingly have a disease, especially a deadly disease, and you assault somebody sexually, that would enhance whatever charges might come against you in the future.
Yeah, that's obviously a best question for a prosecutor.
Right.
But certainly I would think that that would increase the charges in a case.
Another text talked about sexual assault between siblings. Does that happen very often?
So that does happen. It's more common in our younger patients. So the CJC probably sees a lot more of that.
Okay.
We have seen some sibling assaults on the adolescent and adult side, but typically it has been going on for a period of time in their youth.
Let's take a quick phone call. Hey, thanks for calling in. You're on with Andy in Camden. What's going on?
Yes, thanks, Andy. How you doing this morning?
Doing okay. How about you?
Excellent, thank you. And I want to thank the two guests there about their service here they're providing. I'm aware of the Dove Center. Did you say you guys work hand in hand with the Dove Center and as a voluntary service to the community?
Yeah, so we partner very closely with the Dove Center. In fact, we ask that a Dove Center advocate be present in the emergency department to help support our survivors as we're doing our examinations. And so unless that survivor does not want them present, they do have a choice to have them present or not. But we always offer to have an advocate there with us because they are offering that ongoing, continuing support after that patient leaves the emergency department. Now, if they're an adolescent patient, then we're partnering with the Children's Justice Center where they're going to that location or receiving services from our Washington County CJC, which also includes therapy, forensic interview, follow-up care, and many, many other services to help these people heal from the trauma.
Well, that sounds great. And so you're a nonprofit. I was just wondering how the community could, what we could do to support you.
Well, thank you for that question. We, you know, as a brand new nonprofit, we are still pending our 501c3 status. Our application has been in for several months, but we're dealing with the federal government for approval on that. Our lawyer ensures us that, you know, we have everything that we need to be an established 501c3. And actually, we're working with Utah Nonprofit Legal Services, who is our lawyer, and they're out of the Murray area and near Salt Lake, and they are offering fiscal sponsorship. So you can donate to them in our name, and 100% of your donation comes to our team, and those donations will help us pay for supplies that we need, paying call time for nurses, and, you know, really helping us help the survivors of our community. So we are in great need. Right now, we don't have a website because everything costs money. So we're still really new as a nonprofit, and we do have an amazing board. I want to give a shout out to all of our board members,
including Lisa.
And these board members are volunteering their time to support our organization and guide us and direct us so that we can be sustainable and fiscally responsible as we do this work.
Well, I really want to thank you for your service. It obviously sounds like a very important thing for our community. I really had no idea that something like this wasn't maybe already in place, but just thank you for your service.
Well, thank you very much for the call.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, appreciate it. I've got to get a commercial break in, and we'll talk more with Camden and Lisa right after this timeout. I want to, for just a second, mention Angelica's Mexican Grill. Have you been to Angelica's? Angelica's is AG approved. They were my very first AG approved client here on KDXU. It's a Mexican grill right downtown with fantastic food. In fact, a couple of recent polls have come out. Top 10 Mexican restaurants in the entire state. Angelica's was the only one on the list from St. George. That's pretty cool. And then top 10 restaurants in St. George. No matter what kind of food it is, Angelica's was number 2 on that list. So folks are realizing how good Angelica's really is. Stop by today and try some of their incredible Mexican food right from Angelica's recipe and her family's recipe book. They're located downtown at 101 East St. George Boulevard. You can call ahead and beat the line if you want to, 628-4399. Angelica's is AG approved. Welcome back. Andy here with Camden and Lisa. I'm definitely the ugliest person in the room right now. It's not even close, as a matter of fact. Anyway, thank you guys for coming in. Really appreciate it. Lisa, tell us about what's going on this afternoon.
Well, this afternoon, the St. George Area Chamber of Commerce is seeking to honor 3 specific women who are generating major business and economic contributions to the Washington County area.
Okay.
So there's a luncheon taking place today in Santa Clara. And the reason for this award is so that they are recognizing extraordinary women in our community who are in their element. That's why we named it that.
And we have an extraordinary woman in the room right now, don't we?
We do. And therefore, I nominated Camden for this award, and she was selected for that, and we'll be receiving that honor this afternoon. What it shows is evidence is that women like Camden and other women in our community who are doing these extraordinary things are doing what they do best, breaking down the barriers that we aren't aware of in our community, which is why we asked to come on the radio today, is to create more awareness in our community about what sexual assault looks like, how to respond to it, how family members and other advocates in our area are supporting this, and now the need for support on a higher level. Since this is a nonprofit, it isn't going to fund itself. It's going to take the community to stand behind it and to help us reach those goals that Camden was speaking about.
If you want to call, by the way, it's 435-773-2015. That's Southwest Forensic Healthcare. And actually, Camden might even answer the phone herself.
Yep, I will answer the phone myself. And my email address, or the team's email address, is contact@swforensichealthcare.org. And you can also reach my partner, Megan Riddle, at 435-256-2912. And she will also answer herself. So if there's anyone who didn't feel comfortable calling in or has additional questions, certainly we would love to hear from you and be available to support you. We do have a Facebook page and an Instagram and a LinkedIn social media site. We hope to have our website by the end of the month. End of April, I should say. We're working on that right now. And it is sexual assault. Assault Awareness Month in April, so I encourage all of you to find an event in the community. There are several that are going to be going on. The Dove Center website has all of those listed out. We'll be doing a couple at Utah Tech University, as well as a few in the community. The one really impactful one is What Was She Wearing, which is going to be at Utah Tech University, to see what were women wearing when they were sexually assaulted, because once again, those myths of she was scantily dressed and drunk are not really who our survivors are.
Yeah, I think that maybe that's the biggest takeaway today is sexual assault is happening here, number one. And number two, it's usually someone we know and trust that does it, not somebody who jumps out of the bushes. Camden, thank you for coming on today. Lisa, I appreciate you putting this all together.
You bet. Thank you for
having
us.
Thank you, Andy.